Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you are a returning subscriber, hello, best friend in the world. Hope you're having an amazing day. You see what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts? You get that bonus greeting on every episode. So hit the subscribe button. We have an awesome episode today with my man, Robert Zaft. How's it going, Robert?
Great. Thank you, Nick. Great to be back on.
Yeah, good to see you, man. So we're just going to dive into it. We're talking all things ESG today. You've written a bunch of stuff on it. I saw a couple of your recent articles in Forbes that were on this topic. And, you know, look, some people are saying, you know, ESG is new. Some people are saying it's been around for a long time. I've just found it to be generally a pretty unbalanced conversation. And so I think you really presented a lot of the nuance and the dynamics of this whole ESG movement in a really balanced way. And you brought up some interesting perspectives on it. So excited to get you on and kind of pick your brain on it. So for those who haven't checked out our last episode, absolutely check it out. What's your elevator pitch? How do you describe yourself, Robert? And who are you in this broad ethics and compliance ethosphere?
Well, I'm the author of The Right Way to Win, Making Business Ethics Work in the Real World. And what I think distinguishes my approach is my view is that the same managerial tools and techniques that drive ethical behavior also drive business success. And I come at this not as an academic, although I teach at Olin Business School. I have 30 years of business experience, including in some pretty hairy places like Russia in the 1990s. And so I am a practitioner, a lawyer, former McKinsey consultant. I've been in the business side. And so I'm really just trying to make things work in the real world. That means, one, understanding how people really behave, understanding how the world really works. And then also, particularly in the context of something like ESG, saying, okay, we understand the ideas behind it. We understand its importance and its aspirations. How do we put it in a proper business context, business ethics context, so that it actually fits and so that we're doing what we're supposed to be doing as business owners and business managers while we're forwarding ESG, also keeping our eye on the other things we're responsible for?
So what I always like about our conversations is kind of what you talked about. It's this bridge from the theoretical to the practical. It's kind of putting the rubber on the road, so to speak, or the boots on the ground. In this area, I think you lend a lot of great insights too, because it's in, again, this sort of nascent stage. It hasn't sort of gotten its sea legs and hasn't been totally integrated in, you know, however you want to look at it, most organizations or most big companies or whatever. We're seeing the early sprouts of it. Let's kind of back up and let's just talk kind of big picture. Mm-hmm. What is ESG? What are these different sort of approaches? You know, and I'm kind of dancing around the dualism and the high idealism, you know?
Well, there are different formulations and different terms that have been bandied about for some decades now in this area. So at one point, people were talking about a triple bottom line. Mm-hmm. People are talking about corporate social responsibility. Lines seem to be intersecting over this expression ESG, which means environmental, social, and governance concerns. And the idea is that the corporation should not operate blind in their pursuit of shareholder wealth creation to these other considerations. And it's very important, though, how you understand, how you put these in context and where they fit in the larger scheme of both corporate governance as well as, I would say, compliance and business ethics. Because if you look through the wrong end of the telescope, you're not going to get the right view of what you're supposed to be doing, either as an entrepreneur or as a manager. And that's really where I'm trying to focus the conversation right now. I'm not trying to pick one side or the other. What I do see is that the term is growing like kudzu, and that is it's really expanding rapidly. It's become a hot topic. And what I've seen from my time as an international expert with the OECD is when topics can get funding, they suddenly get conferences, they get papers, people can get tenure based upon them, people can build their careers based upon them. And you see this great push, which is not necessarily consistent with founding principles or even necessarily business logic, that it becomes an interest group of its own.
Right.
And so what I think we need to do in a thoughtful and respectful fashion is say, okay, what is the real grounding of environmental, social, and governance? Where does it belong in the compliance and corporate governance structure? And what are our duties with respect to it as people who are responsible for managing businesses? So it's a call for reason.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So I love that picture you painted of looking through the wrong end of the telescope. So just to flesh that out some more, do you mean that essentially ethics and compliance or governance can sort of manifest itself in a corporate structure kind of any number of different ways, but that's going to fall on one of two ends of the spectrum, one being sort of that stakeholder value creation approach versus the sort of shareholder value creation approach? Are you saying that the posture of those departments or those organizations within the broader organization are going to manifest in sort of meaningfully different ways?
Well, I'd say the pill that people have to swallow, and to some people it's a bitter pill and to some people it's a sweet pill, is when you're managing assets that don't entirely belong to you, doing the right thing is not about your personal preferences, no matter how noble, no matter how wonderful. They're about doing your duty. And so an example I use in my book is I have a hypothetical family business where the owner decides to give all the profits after tax to the Sierra Club. And you say, well, the person indirectly owns all the assets anyway. That's not a problem. But then I introduce a sibling. I introduce cousins who don't work for the business. And the example really shows that, you know what? Giving away all the profits of a company's activities that you run when you don't own all the assets is not ethical. Right. It exploits the non-controlling shareholders. It represents corporate waste or self-dealing in a sense. And so my point is that even well-intended things are not necessarily ethical, and they're not necessarily consistent with proper compliance and proper corporate governance. And so if we're going to talk about ESG, it's really important, in my view, as a legal matter and as an ethical matter, to situate it in the appropriate context. Mm-hmm. So if you think about most companies in the United States are governed by state laws that require the company's managers to maximize shareholder wealth. That would be called the theoretical term, or the academic term, is dualism. Milton Friedman was an exponent of this. And they say, you know what? You as the manager should focus on maximizing company wealth. That's a relatively easy metric. We can hold your feet to the fire. It avoids dispersion of effort. Mm-hmm. Right? There's another school of thought, which is stakeholder theory or high idealism, which says that no, the fact is that there are people other than the shareholders of a company who have a rightful claim to the assets and to the proceeds from the activities of the company. Those would include the employees, the creditors, the suppliers, and the community where the companies operate. And it's important to understand on what basis the company is acting, on what basis the owners are acting. So I mentioned that in most cases in the United States, companies are going to have a context in which they're supposed to maximize shareholder wealth.
That's not always an angle.
Right. But what's happened over the years is there's been a development in corporate law. So, for example, in Delaware, which is the paragon of dualism, they've created these public benefit corporations, which under state law are supposed to balance maximizing shareholder returns with some other public benefit, which is described in the charter of the corporation itself.
Denominated in whatever that benefit is denominated in.
It would say that we're going to promote ecological behavior, or we're going to promote social development or whatnot. And so now that's appropriate. Now the directors, the officers, the other fiduciaries of the company have legal authority to balance things in that way.
Yeah.
All right. So now they're acting properly. And what you might find in some other jurisdictions in Europe, for example, is that the company law itself will be highly idealistic or will permit concerns other than maximizing shareholder value. In Germany, for example, typically half the people on the supervisory board of a major company are going to come from the workforce.
Super interesting.
Either the employees themselves or from the union. And what that really says, that balancing is going to take place at the supervisory level as well, at least with respect to the stakeholder concerns of the employees themselves.
I mean, that's a pretty interesting model. That there's almost like a vote or something from the workforce to have some representation on this board. Why do you think that hasn't made its way over here?
I think it has to do with the historical and political development of the different countries. So that you had, you know, the failed revolutions of 1848 in and among the German states, their consolidation under Prussian leadership and Bismarck, and the way he approached social welfare legislation. So
those roots are there, is the point. That kind of foundational approach is, this is kind of an outcropping of that or something.
There's a context. There's a historical and a social context. Now, whether things are going to flow together over time, we're going to see. But another point I make is that even a dualistic company, even a company that is completely devoted to maximizing shareholder wealth, cannot pursue shareholder wealth maximization blind to reputational blowback.
Yeah, that's right.
So if you get a reputation for being a terrible employer that doesn't care about its employees, if you get a reputation for doing the absolute minimum in your community, not caring about the community. I live in St. Louis, so we can think of Stan Kroenke, who was the owner of the St. Louis Rams, who moved the team to Los Angeles. And St. Louis is now suing him for about $1 billion, saying, wait, how could you yank our team from us?
Right.
Notwithstanding the fact that we actually took it from Los Angeles a few decades ago.
Stop. I mean, that's too many details.
Okay. But my larger point practically is, I think there is this academic or theoretical debate between the pure profit maximizers and the stakeholder people. And my guess is that that's never going to get solved. There's no mathematical proof that says, aha, this is the way it must be. You're going to have different contexts and experiences in legal regimes and societies. My point is that in the real world, where we all have to operate, except for the academics, of course, a practical resolution is to say, look, I have to worry about my reputation. I have to be seen as a good corporate citizen, as a good employer, et cetera. These are all ways that will help me maximize value over time. I need to be cognizant of them.
Yeah.
At the same time, if I'm so engaged with my stakeholders and so engaged with my E and my G that I start running huge losses, I'm either going to go bankrupt or I'm going to be taken over by a competitor that can balance better, or I'm going to be taken over or beaten in the market by a competitor who's solely focused on profit maximization, or at least is far more focused on it than I am. And that's why I'm just saying that in the real world, there's always a certain amount of balancing that goes on, but understanding what your duties are within the context of the legal regime is important, because if you don't abide by that, you're not acting ethically, you're not fulfilling your duties, and you're not complying with the law. And it doesn't matter how well-intentioned you are. At the end of the day, you have to do what you're supposed to do. That's part of the pill. But it also informs then how you might think about, where does ESG fit into our larger plans? Mm-hmm. And that's an appropriate question to ask. In fact, it's an essential question to ask. Otherwise, you're running around like a chicken with your head cut off.
Yeah, you're just reacting to everything. And you don't end up making any sort of meaningful progress on either side of that fence.
Or you're actually working to the detriment of what you're supposed to be, which is not ethical,
right?
And not good management.
Yeah, it's, you're not being a good fiduciary. You're not being a good steward of the resources that are essentially entrusted to you. I don't know if you've ever read, or I don't know what you know about the Wealth of Nations written by Adam Smith, but I'm going to sort of say this and would love to hear your kind of reaction to it. It seems almost as if, so in that book, which for, you know, shorthand, let's call that the blueprint for the quote unquote free market that we're in right now, right? Mm-hmm. In that sort of free market economy that he was describing, he talked about some of the things you just mentioned with respect to a company's reputation, and that, you know, if you're trying to cut your costs so much and your quality falls through the floor in the context of a small bakery in a little village or something, well, someone's going to go to the other bakery, or someone's going to open up a better bakery, and so forth. So in this sort of free market approach, there was at least discussed this sort of self-correcting mechanism for the implications of a business beyond those dollars on the bottom of the balance sheet or at the bottom of the P&L. It seems like that idea kind of got a little twisted. Maybe these are the wrong words. I'm not trying to lead you by any means, but it seems like these ideas sort of got twisted with the Milton Friedman approach that sort of myopically collapsed it down to shareholder value creation, profitability, and so forth. And it seems like it was maybe a precursor or a related thought to this like trickle-down economics that I think some people think didn't work, some people think it did work. But I'd like you to, you know, kind of, I'd like your reaction to that. And I'd like, you know, I guess I want to kind of chew on how this self-correcting mechanism that in theory should be in place, reputational sort of subjective things that are not as objective as the dollars or the profit that an organization is generating, how these sort of self-correcting mechanisms in this theoretical quasi-free market economy that we're in aren't enough to the, you know, as evidenced by the fact that ESG needs to even be part of this conversation. Like, why is that self-correcting mechanism not active enough to, you know, not cause this ESG conversation to be sort of blasting into all of our minds and, you know, thoughts?
Well, that's a great question. It's good to be careful about our use of terms, because the people who are in the debate to make money from the debate will often use emotionally laden terms that they never really unpack, or that sometimes obscure more than they explain. So in my understanding of Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, he talked about how in pursuing one's own self-interest as a business person, you end up working towards the communal good, because you're trying to provide a good or a service that satisfies your customers at a lower cost than that of your competitors.
Correct.
If we go forward into the Milton Friedman's day, what he said was that it is actually the moral thing for the directors and the officers to seek to maximize shareholder wealth, but it was subject to obeying the law, and it was subject to observing commercial custom where you operate. So right. It wasn't this blind full speed ahead, damn the torpedoes approach. It was saying, this is the right thing for the company to do, because the decisions of distribution of societal wealth or dealing with the labor force or dealing with the communities or the environment are simply better executed through other institutions of society. Who's better at making an ecological balance? The legislature or the city council in passing ordinances on environmental protection or on labor protection? So I think what Friedman was arguing was that it's better for those institutions. They have more societal legitimacy because right. they're elected. They have a wider perspective, and they can also spread costs more effectively than an individual organization can. The other thing Friedman, I think, was focusing on was the difficulty of monitoring managers. And that is, if we're just focused on shareholder wealth maximization, that's a pretty clear indicator over time to say how well is this management doing, assuming it's obeying the law and complying with commercial customs, as we said. Now what happens is, if they're starting to have to balance, how do I know how they're doing? How do I know I'm not just getting excuses? How do they know how to allocate capital? So, you know, point I make in my book is, all right, we have after-tax profits. Do we reinvest it in the business by buying more equipment to make ourselves more efficient? Mm-hmm. Do we give employees an extra bonus to be nice to them? Do we take the money and contribute it to a community park? And then the question is, how will we measure management's performance? And are we going to protect them from other companies that aren't so concerned with spreading the wealth? And if we start protecting them, are we going to be entrenching incompetence and waste and corruption as an inadvertent result of this? So that is the argument in favor of dualism or shareholder wealth maximization. There are some arguments against, and they would say, look, in the real world, we know that you think that regulatory bodies and legislatures should be passing the rules around ESG concerns, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But we all know that as these economic organizations, these businesses get richer and more powerful, there's a tendency for them to capture the legislatures through lobbying and through campaign contributions. And there's a tendency for them to capture the regulators who are supposed to put curbs on their behavior, in part because they're giving money to the regulators who appropriate the money to fund the regulators, mm-hmm. in part because there can be a revolving door of regulators in and out of the businesses, which you might see in various ways, no matter what party's in power, right?
Right.
A certain revolving door at the political level. So that would be a countervailing concern. And the issue is framed by Robert Clark, who's the former dean of Harvard Law School and really the foremost corporate governance academic in the country, I believe, is, okay, wealth maximization has its issues, it has its challenges, but do we drop it if we can't find anything better? So part of Clark's concern is, can we find anything that actually works better than this, even with all of its problems?
Yeah, and also, what do you mean by works better? Or what does he mean by works better?
Well, I mean, that would be the
whole thing is amorphous. You know what I'm saying?
Well, in saying you get better wealth accumulation, environmental protection, societal advancement, and governance by letting the companies focus on making money. One can make the argument. I'm just going to make the argument. Mm-hmm. Reasonable people can disagree that what has lifted more people out of dire poverty faster than at any time in human history has been India and China stepping away from centrally planned socialism and embracing market economics.
Right.
It was Milton Friedman's view, and you're welcome to disagree with him. He said, look, if you focus on freedom, you get both freedom and greater equality. If you focus on equality, you get neither freedom nor equality. And so the best way for the people at the bottom to do well is to grow the whole pie. That's the argument. Again, people can argue with it. I would say if you look at the Soviet Union, where people were miserably poor, but relatively equal, that was probably not such a great outcome. Or if you look in China, where they had regular widespread famine under socialist economies, that wasn't such a great thing. So it's inevitable that as you free up the economy and as the economy becomes global, those people who can best operate in that environment may become super rich. But if at the time they're becoming super rich, the poorest of the poor are actually moving out of dire poverty, maybe that's not such a bad outcome.
Yeah.
So I think that the, just as you can't consider giving money of the business to a charity in isolation, you can't think about inequality in isolation. For example,
correct,
you have a room full of billionaires and Bezos walks in and suddenly inequality in the room has shot up markedly. Do we care? Well, they're all billionaires.
Well, that's a great point. You know, we're highly attuned as humans to like find relative differences in things, right? You can just get a raise, but then you find out that you're the lowest paid on your team. Now that raise doesn't feel as good, right? We can always see, you know, you put two things next to each other, you can always see the difference there.
Right.
And I think we run the risk of, in this sort of massive multi-factor equation that is our sort of global economy, we run the risk of, you know, to your point, kind of fixating on those people at the high end of the spectrum, these super, super rich people, and say, look at all of this inequality, and not look at this sort of historical relative difference of the people at the bottom, to your point, who are maybe floating at a higher level than they were a generation ago or something as a result of, you know, the economic growth or whatever, which inevitably is going to generate this sort of Pareto distribution that we're talking about that, you know, essentially, this billionaires, you know, the burr in the saddle that billionaires are to the average person is a function of this Pareto distribution that is inevitable in any sort of creative endeavor, right? It's kind of the 80-20 rule, right? 80%, this is just directional, of course, 80% right, of the money is controlled by 20% of the people, and that continues to fractal down to your point, in that room full of billionaires, when Jeff Bezos comes in, 80% of that money is concentrated in him, right? That's an inevitable result of any sort of creative pursuit or anything that where discretionary effort is applied in sort of a complex system. And we run the risk, I think, of over-focusing on that quote-unquote inequality at the top because of those relative differences that are easily observable. And we run the risk, I guess, perhaps, in sort of a full pendulum swing to the other side of let's go sort of full ESG, of having a bunch of essentially companies that are kind of in central planning mode, kind of an amalgamation of what was represented in China or Russia from that sort of planning at a state level, where there's kind of, it just ends up getting so muddied and so forth. There's not that sort of direct, you know, focus or pursuit of an individual thing.
Well, the planners are the ones who end up taking the money.
Yeah.
So right. Even in the 1920s, yeah, after the Bolsheviks took over, at one point, Lenin, in a private moment with, the Western oil man, Armin Hammer, said, it doesn't work. and he moved towards what was called the new economic policy, which was allowing smaller scale capitalism to exist. One of his principal ideologues, Bukharin, talked about state capitalism. And what happens is all the woes of capitalism in terms of exploitation are present. It's just the people who run the state who are the exploiters.
Oh,
that might sound familiar to some people, at least as a concern, if not an actual fact. So look, it's important to understand our own motivations. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that I think thou shalt not covet is a pretty good commandment and something we have to think about when the success or the excess of certain people upsets us.
Yeah.
That we might be upset on one level morally, but we also might say, you know what? It's also not right to covet somebody else's stuff. And if it's been earned honestly and lawfully, and you think about the good that that person has done. So let's pick somebody who's a bit more popular, maybe in the public mind than a Bezos. You can think about Steve Jobs, who was a multi-billionaire. He changed the way we lived. He brought beautiful things to us. So these are people who appreciably improve the lives of hundreds of millions of people who also make a lot of other people wealthy, et cetera. So that's not in behavior to be discouraged, in my view.
Well, right.
Even when you have a legitimate question, which is to say, how should societal resources be allocated? And here, I think, you know, one of Milton Friedman's heroes would have been John Locke, mm-hmm. the Scottish theorist, and who talked about something becomes our property because we go out in nature and we mix our labor with it and we bring it back. So mm-hmm. we go out in the forest and we're the ones who gather the nuts. And so we bring the nuts back and there are nuts and we can eat them or sell them as we will. Mm-hmm. Locke is assuming plenty. He's assuming there's enough out there, so to speak, in the wilderness for everybody to go out and get something. But classical economics assumes scarcity, that there isn't enough for everybody. So you can't go too far on to one side to say the market will take care of everything. I don't think that's realistic. And there is scarcity. That's part of how we think economies operate. But I also would avoid going too far over in terms of societal or governmental control.
Right.
As opposed to other forms of social suasion, which you would tend to get, for example, from religious groups, where the religions themselves believe that we have an obligation as the created of our creator to help other people. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't just have to be an issue of what should the state do, it should be how do people and societies function as complex organisms. So we're getting pretty far afield, I guess, from ESG, but I'm just saying that, you know, if many of the people who say that the rich should pay their fair share probably have no conception of how much the rich actually pay as a percentage of the pie, right? So one figure one tends to read is that the top 1% are paying about half of the income tax.
Again, there's the Pareto law in action there again,
so,
right?
So, you know, how much weight do you want to pull on the ox that's pulling the, do you want to put on the ox that's pulling the wagon before the ox stops pulling or just simply dies?
Well, that's the, like, that is the risk of a lot of this. If the pendulum swings too far to the other side, you know, I mean, just as a starting point, obviously in a free market, everything should correct itself. And in a theoretical free market, there should be no hand other than the invisible hand that's guiding everything. Obviously that leaves room for a ton of exploitation and a ton of like malfeasance essentially. So there needs to be some corrections. I think swinging too far to the other side, to your point, can, you know, you run the risk of basically upsetting or breaking the sort of incentive structures that are in place that drive the innovation and drive the new production of quote unquote beautiful things or whatever these things are that could change our world. To your point, the last thing you want to do is kill the ox that's pulling half of the cart weight. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there are legitimate concerns about how companies operate and maintaining a free market does require some regulation. You need to have the institution of contract, for example. You do need to have the government providing certain common goods that it really only makes sense for the government to provide.
Yep.
Like defense or infrastructure networks. So Milton Friedman did not argue for total laissez-faire, the government should do nothing. Right. So the government should focus on the things that really only governments can do or on situations where there are what he called neighborhood effects. Mm-hmm. And that would be his rationale, for example, for funding public education, is to say that an environment where people can't get educated has spillover effects on everybody else. And from the perspective of neighborhood effects, it's appropriate for public funds to be used in that fashion. What he did, though, do is he said we should use vouchers to maximize choice and the kind of competition that brings us so much enriching and highly productive stuff in one context, we should have another. So, you know, prison food is not known for its quality. And the reason is they have their monopoly provider to force takers.
Right.
And one might make a similar argument in terms of some other public goods like education to say, you know what, maybe vouchers make more sense here. That's a very sensitive issue, and I don't want to get too far afield, but I'm just trying to give some perspective on Friedman. He wasn't a fool, and he wasn't blind to the way the world operates. He did have his determined views, and in some places, they seem to have been proven out.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to say that if you're going to talk about ESG, and if you are understandably and rightfully concerned with the environmental, social, and governance impacts of how your organization is running, you have to understand what the background end goal of your organization is according to the law and according to your company charter. So
right.
a point that people don't seem to make that I think is important, for example, is now that state laws in Delaware and New Jersey and other places create this option of a public benefit corporation, the implication is companies that aren't public benefit corporations should really focus on profit maximization. Before you had an option, before there was an alternative, you might have a better argument to say all companies should do this. But now that the law gives people the option to balance, you know, one-way balance, and I think the implication is the other one is we don't balance as a matter of the end goal of the company. But as we discussed earlier, because of reputational blowback, you have to balance, but you have to balance in the context of a different end goal. And that ultimately makes a difference in how we approach things. So that's one aspect of it that I think is worth raising and worth understanding, because a lot of people are talking about doing the right thing, but I don't think they really have unpacked what doing the right thing means in different contexts.
So let's talk about that. There's so much I want to kind of dive into. Before we talk about that, you know, what quote unquote doing the right thing means in different contexts, I just want to circle back to this comment you made about Friedman. You know, you said the guy was not an idiot. He knew how the world worked. And I think there's a lot of people kind of talking about ESG who haven't even read that New York Times article from the late 70s that kind of kicked off this whole thing. And like, if you read it, a lot of his concerns or a lot of like the ESG concerns are kind of addressed in it. And he was just saying like, well, the most efficient path to these sort of externalities that we're all looking for, a better society, you know, blah, 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 can best be achieved by the focus, to your point, you know, profit maximization of organizations. But it's just, you know, when people talk about this sort of stakeholder approach, it's almost like demonized, like at least it feels like it in today's, you know, parlance, that it's almost demonized and it's like such a cold-hearted thing. And it may be, but I'm just saying the basis for that, at least try to incorporate some of these other sort of subjective facets. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I would say it has been, may not be, but it has been in our national character to assume that reasonable people can have differences of opinion, even over some major aspects of public life and public policy. And so I think that it's possible to believe that the best way to advance not just business, but societal and environmental goals is through focus on shareholder wealth maximization by companies. And it might be a mistaken view, okay? But I don't think it's necessarily a cold-hearted view. In the same way that people who are applying a stakeholder or highly idealistic approach, are they necessarily soft, warm-hearted if the ideas don't necessarily work, or if they're not thinking through the complications that would then arise, or if they're not open to unpacking their own self-interest in something? And I worry as I see the proliferation of experts and consultants and rules and regulations to say, how many people are making their living from this? And if they're making their living from this, do they have any incentive to stop? Or is their incentive simply to find ever new ways to entwine something and to add another aspect to the disclosure requirements, et cetera? Some people might characterize it unfavorably, saying it's like the Medici Church, which had to raise money to build the Vatican, and they sent people out to sell indulgences.
Yeah.
So now you have people, you know, out there selling carbon offset stuff, and you have people who have are billionaires who have multiple houses and private planes. And when you ask them about the discrepancy between their lifestyle and their stated views on environmental protection, let's say, or whatnot, they're going to say, well, I buy carbon offsets. Which to me sounds a lot like, well, I just got indulgences from the Medici Church, so I'm going to heaven.
Yeah, we're just trading indulgences over here.
I'm going to have a really nice room there, right? So,
but again, let's double click on that, because I think there are some interesting dynamics around, like, I definitely get your point. And it seems sort of disingenuous at some level. But, you know, I just have this kind of burning question, and maybe it's a stupid one, but like, how do you denominate someone's ESG performance? Like, you can denominate our company performance in currencies and in numbers and so forth. But for disparate businesses that are functioning in different markets that have different, you know, E, S, or G kind of challenges, how do you sort of compare across these different groups on who's having more benefit or, you know, doing better? Like, how do you know if someone's doing better? You know, it's almost like a car race where, you know, you kind of come in last and they say, well, you lost the race, and you're like, well, this is running on corn oil. You know, yeah, I lost the race, but this is running on corn oil. Like, maybe I'm not saying it cleanly, but how do we know, like, how do we know who won the race? You know what I'm saying?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. What is the race? But as these concerns have grown, you then have the question of, well, what disclosure should we make?
Right.
How do we measure our own success? How do we benchmark? And particularly now, there's been this enormous rush of trillions of dollars into ESG friendly investing.
Yes.
That was part of the point of the Forbes article, because an issue around Exxon, et cetera, have they been greenwashing? And then these accusations have arisen in other places that you say that you're involved in green or sustainable investing, but you're not really involved in it. It's greenwashing. And so now you have standards bodies, right? You have some of the rating agencies that started to look at, we're going to rate environmentally, we're going to rate the social part, we'll rate the governance part. And you have competing bodies now that are trying to figure out different systems. Am I going to go with Moody's or Fitch, for example, or S&P?
Yeah.
And it's a quandary. And I'm advising a global financial services company right now, which has got a difficult situation in terms of procurement, which is, if we want to try to buy from suppliers who are themselves doing their best or doing well in the ESG area, how do we evaluate them? Right? Procurement people are busy, right? It's hard enough trying to run a regular procurement process, but now he's saying, okay, I got to add another layer of ESG analysis onto this. Okay, how do I do this? Because I don't have time to check. And the fact is, if part of my evaluation is the use of child labor or slave labor, I really can't rely on self-disclosure by this supplier, because someone who's exploiting and abusing children in slave labor, you know, might actually fudge the truth on a form.
Right.
So that is the practical problem, which is, you know, there's a race that I try to establish standards. But that happens in any new field, right? Where someone invents a new thingamabob and suddenly they have to say, well, okay, we can now video record stuff. What format should we use?
Right.
Or we're going to have an operating system. What should be compatible with what operating system? Now, where the things are actually better, you can expect them to shake out over time. So in other words, if you really thought that ESG investing was intrinsically better, that it intrinsically produced higher returns to the investors, you wouldn't have to worry, because the person at the top of the pile at the end of the match would be the best. And you say, okay, what they're doing is what must be the best. That's the survival of the fittest. And that's if you believe that ESG investing produces intrinsically higher returns.
Okay.
Now, what if it doesn't? If it doesn't, you can say it still produces higher overall returns, because what happens is people are willing to do business with you because of the psychic income they derive from knowing that their income is coming from proper behavior, from moral business behavior. It's like saying
a virtuous company or something. It's a virtuous investment.
or how much more would you pay for tuna that was, was certified dolphin free, that I knew that no dolphins were killed in the catching of this tuna. Basically, I'd be happy to pay an extra quarter a can or 50 cents a can, maybe even a dollar a can, right? But what that then means is, well, who's going to make sure this is actually dolphin free tuna? Because people now have an incentive to lie to get the premium.
Right.
So what you're seeing is a rush inward of organizations that are trying to provide some form of certification, and they overlap and they differ. Then the question is, well, I think about how many different kinds of kosher certification are there? Probably dozens.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah. And, you know, when you talked about Moody's, Fitch and S&P, I think that's a great kind of corollary to where something like this may settle out, because comparability of, you know, credit, is very hard across industries, across different balance sheet, across different, you know, investment profiles. And it's kind of shaken out to a few that I kind of everybody uses. And so, okay, so there's a way to kind of do well, but again, that is again, a bond. That's a financial instrument. And like pricing out a bond is kind of straightforward in the sense it's like all numbers, you know what I mean?
It's not just that, but you can rate the rater. In other words, I met actually about 20 years ago. I was working for the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. I was doing corporate governance in Asia, Eurasia, and Russia, and you know, parts of the West. And I met with the agency because they were thinking about trying to develop corporate governance ratings. They already did the credit ratings. And I said, look, I said, the credit rating is a pretty simple question, which is, how likely is this company to pay its bills, its debts as they come due?
Right.
And they said, not only is that a pretty straightforward question, but it allows you to ask a rate the rater question, which is,
correct,
how many debts rated AAA by this rating agency have gone bad in the last 6 months?
Right. Okay? Or so, you could look back and you can get a sample and look back and say, well, now that these have reached maturity, what should they have been rated at now that we know everything? That's another way to kind of get at it, to your point.
But I'm just saying, if I have a rating agency that can, that regularly blows it, I'm going to say, I don't care. I'm not going to use it. This is an issue in 2008 when the AAA bonds went bad. And you're saying, well, you know, this the bond rating agencies themselves can be evaluated by how well they predict solvency and insolvency.
That's right.
Across the different bands of AAA, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I said corporate governance is a very different issue. Not only is it a lot more complicated, you're asking a lot of different questions, but the fact is you can have a company with perfect corporate governance, it's a lousy investment. And that's really the dirty little secret of corporate governance. And that is, a company with perfect corporate governance and no positive cash flow is worth nothing.
You need profit. You need profit to hit your purpose. You know what I'm saying?
I'm saying a company with lousy corporate governance, but that generates free cash flow is actually worth something. And my point was, not only did that make the rating somewhat a questionable enterprise to begin with.
Yeah, right.
But you had to think, you had to make sure that you didn't so wrap the company in governance stuff that it couldn't function as a business enterprise, because what you were doing was you were actually preventing the company from performing its basic function, which is generate free cash flow.
Yeah, if every business has a purpose, at least, you know, at some sort of foundational level of like continuing to exist as a going concern, then if some of these ESG, for again, shorthand, subsume those priorities and ultimately, you know, accelerate it not being a going concern anymore, then how can those be how could those have been the right things to do?
Right. I made the mistake once of asking a Russian scientist friend of mine, I said, this data needs to be secure. And what can you do? He said, oh, you want it secure. I will put it on a tape. I will put tape inside of radioactive concrete. I will surround concrete with broken glass and barbed wire. Data will be secure. Is that what you need? Okay. So making the point that when I said secure, I also had to have it accessible, right? Making it secure but inaccessible defeats the purpose of we're here. That was my point about corporate governance, which is, if you so surround these companies with rules and regulations to the point where they can't operate as businesses, you've really kind of lost the point of why the business is there in the first place. And the fact is, we have to be willing to accept a certain amount of corporate governance leakage to allow the businesses to operate. That gets back to your point of the invisible hand, because ultimately the operation of the business is going to be evaluated by the market.
Yeah.
Both both the commercial market of people who want to buy the goods and services or do business with them, and by the investing market. So that, here again, you know, what's, you don't want the, they say there's a game worth the candle. You don't want to so wrap up these companies and other concerns that they're unable to function as businesses, and you're not making sensible trade-offs. So I'll, you know, two cases come to mind. In the Global Reporting Initiative, you have global financial services company reporting on the use of plastic in their cafeterias.
Needle mover? Is that a needle mover? That's like, yeah.
I'm just saying, you know, one question is, well, the plastic stuff, it's cheap. It doesn't take a lot of energy to produce. It's sanitary, so people aren't going to get sick from dirty silverware. And you dispose of it properly, you know, it's disposed of. Whereas I have to, you know, mine the aluminum or the bauxite. I got to turn it into aluminum. I got to produce a knife, right? I got to ship the knife. I got to, you know, put it out. The person uses it. Now I got to wash it. Well, I need a person. I need a dishwasher. I need electricity. I need hot water.
Yeah.
So how are we going to think about trade-offs, right? So yeah. In what areas are we thinking that we're virtuous? But with a little examination, things might not quite be so clear. So if you think about all the dead birds at the bottom of a windmill, you might say, some of which might be endangered or threatened species, you might be saying, maybe this stuff is not as clean as we thought. Or when you look at the landfills that are filled with these giant carbon fiber blades, it can't be recycled.
Yeah.
You got to say, you know, are we looking broadly enough at this to say that on balance, we're doing the right thing? So that's kind of within each silo of ESG to say, well, are we really understanding the trade-offs appropriately? But then across the silos, and this is to your larger point, how are we thinking about this? So for example, do I donate a gas power generator to a village in Africa so they can have lighting after dark and the kids can study and maybe they can have internet access? Or do I leave them in darkness so that they don't, and they don't generate any green, carbon?
Yeah. Green though, right.
So, One has to be careful of in all of this is that there's a tendency to kind of migrate towards the stuff you can easily measure.
Correct.
And that's why carbon dioxide is such an easy villain, because you say, well, I can calculate my carbon output and I can buy offsets. And that's relatively easy to do. Mm-hmm. And so people migrate towards the stuff they can measure because it's easier, not whether it's necessarily the right thing they should be focused on.
Right.
Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I'm just saying that the offset market has allowed people to quantify an offset in ways that are a lot harder than your question about, do I give the electric generator to the African village or not?
Yeah, and we subconsciously do those same offsets in our own quote-unquote mental accounting as you look at one of these windmills or like one of these wind farms, because you're like, look at all that clean energy, but to your point, well, those had to be shipped there. Those had to be produced. The ton of energy had to go into casting all those tubes and those blades and all that other stuff. Those are all costs to get that energy. And many times, to your point, maybe it's because, you know, we're in this like attention economy, or we're bombarded, or maybe because people just don't have like the mental capacity to like really think so deeply about all these things. We run the risk of kind of winding up in kind of this greenwashed ESG world. And I'd love to talk a little bit about this greenwashing aspect, which we've kind of talked about a little bit tangentially here. But right. I like how you talked about kind of both aspects of greenwashing, one of which gets a ton of attention and one kind of doesn't get a lot of attention, but seems like it might be perhaps a bigger issue.
Well, let's not necessarily compare them, because I don't have a basis for doing that. I'd say that the one greenwashing that people are quite aware of is when people are claiming to be engaged in ESG friendly behavior when they're not, or that they're embellishing. And there's this idea in the US of what's called stolen valor. It's actually a federal crime to pretend or to state that you have a military background or military decorations when you don't, in order to get some material advantage. That's,
and also, have you seen those videos on YouTube, the Stolen Valor videos?
I think a couple of photos, maybe.
They're
on
amazing.
Facebook.
They're unbelievable. The, yeah.
Whose uniform makes absolutely no sense.
Exactly. They got, you know, so, Marine things on a, you know, army jacket or something. Yeah, it's right. Crazy.
Now, again, if they're doing it just because they want to play dress up and play make-believe, that might not be a crime. But if they're doing it to get the GI discount,
got it,
then that's actually a crime. there's now this issue, what I call stolen virtue. And this is part of the question because the European Union is moving towards regulations and humane supply chain disclosures. And the SEC under the Biden administration has very clearly decided to move towards mandatory disclosures of information that is not material financial information, but has to do with ESG, mm-hmm. which is a change. Whether it's an authorized change or not, people will argue over. But traditionally, what the SEC has required is a disclosure of material and financial information. But now they're going to move into this other area. So now you're going to have a question, which is, on what basis are you, could you have lawsuits for materially misstating these kinds of disclosures?
Exactly.
And in an area like climate change, I don't know how you would, as a corporation, try to evaluate your impact on the global climate. And whether it's a disclosure, you just say, you know what, we just don't know because this is such a complex thing. We don't know how to do it. Right.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if that's going to, I don't think that's going to wash somehow with the government. But the problem you're going to run into is to say, well, is this just going to generate enormous lawsuits? Because you will have investors who say, well, I invested in you because you said you were doing this stuff. And now I see it was overstated or it was actually a lie.
Yeah. And there's such an incentive to overstate it because there's an implied, you know, cost to not hitting that mark or not making that disclosure. I mean, I guess it happens on both sides. You can fall off either side of the tightrope. But it just, I mean, if you can't answer the question and you can't measure this thing that you're talking about, then you're going to go on one side or the other is the point, you know?
The issue would be, what are your damages? And let's assume I've been buying into a mutual fund that's supposed to be ESG friendly. And I discover that they really aren't that ESG friendly. And then the question is, well, what are my damages? It was, if I'm looking at a non-financial measure, do I have a non-financial damage? Do I say, well, this is fraud, I want punitive damages in the absence of any financial damage? Because they might say, well, had we actually been investing in ESG stuff, we probably would have made less money, not more. So you have no financial damage. In fact, you're better off. And some would say, well, you defrauded me because I wouldn't have given you the money anyway. And now I feel terrible. So if you follow through some of the logical ramifications of where governments are going with this, Are they doing anything other than enriching the lawyers? I don't know. It's a tough one.
Well, and it's this interesting thing. Like, if you look at, there's like so many ESG funds coming out, like EFTs, and just there's a ton of them coming out. But if you look at the holdings of them, they're not like, it's Apple, it's Google. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not like, as I've looked into some of these, I've just been like, this just looks like a regular fund. You know what I'm saying? People are gravitating to these market outperformers that have, again, I'm not accusing these companies of greenwashing, or ESG washing or virtue stealing or whatever you called it, stolen virtue. But it's just, you're already starting to see what seems to me to be these early signs of people riding this ESG wave for their own benefit, when the whole point of it, I think, is sort of a more broad, more altruistic, more holistic view of what the benefits or what the returns, quote unquote, from a given investment are supposed to generate.
Right. Well, to go back to you know, Milton Friedman, he said that very often you get policies where you have very sincere people pushing the policy, but behind them are special interests that are making a ton of money from all of this.
Yeah, right.
And that it's a human fact. And so why wouldn't it happen in some other field? So there's this big rush to ESG. I did have a conversation, not necessarily a happy one, with a fund manager in Asia who was extolling her move into the ESG area. And I said to her, well, how much less return are you willing to make for your limited partners by doing this? And do you disclose that in your placement memoranda? Because you're not being generous with your own money. You're still getting your management fee. And you're being generous with the money of other people. Have you disclosed what you're doing? That, in fact, is the intent of the public benefit corporation statutes, is to say, look, you got to disclose what you're doing. If you're a public benefit corporation, it should be in your charter. And what's been interesting in Delaware, though, is how they've dumbed down that. So it used to be that your name had to indicate that you were a public benefit corporation. No more. It used to be that if you were going to transition from a regular corporation to a public benefit corporation, you needed a unanimous vote of the share of the directors plus a 90% vote of the shareholders. Mm-hmm. That got moved down to 2/3. Now it's gotten moved down to a majority of the shares outstanding. And significantly, there are no dissenters' rights. So typically, a classical protection of shareholders, non-controlling shareholders in corporate law in America has been that if the company is going to merge or take some major action that fundamentally transforms what it does, people who shareholders who dissent from that action can assert dissenters' rights and have their shares before the action appraised by a court, and they get the payout from the court for that amount. Mm-hmm. So imagine that you've invested in a regular company and suddenly 51%, the majority of the board and 51% of the shareholders decide we're going to become a public benefit corporation.
Yep.
Now it just takes a bare majority and you have no dissenters' rights. So in a sense, if you believe, which I think conceptually you almost have to accept, that moving from a shareholder wealth maximizing company to moving to a public benefit company is going to reduce the value of the company to the shareholders. You don't
the
have a remedy
value, at least. Yeah.
You don't have the remedy for that transition. You're in a sense, you know, getting bilked out of it. That's to my mind is problematic. Why this very well-established protection of non-controlling shareholders in company law should not apply to that transition as well.
Yeah, I wonder if it'll, I mean, every public company that's traded on an exchange, at least in our country, is a C Corp, or is that statement false?
These are C Corp is a, that's a tax term. So
there aren't any publicly traded LLCs, I don't think.
That's not a form that you can readily trade in. So let me think for a second. You have trusts, you have real estate investment trusts, which function as partnerships.
Okay.
And so that would be a form you would, if you're thinking about a publicly traded flow through for tax purposes, would tend to be something like a real estate investment trust.
Yeah, which okay, I guess has partnership sort of tax treatment, but is publicly traded. So maybe right, that is a, violation of what I'm talking about, I guess.
We're mixing federal tax treatment and state status as a corporation or an LLC. So
yeah.
Say state law is what governs the formation of corporations. Corporations mm-hmm. are legal entities, so they're really creatures of the law.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you can form a common law general partnership. If you and I decide to open a lemonade stand and share profit and loss, we're now common law general partners. We don't have to sign anything.
Right.
It happens by operation of law.
And we're just taxed however, as sole proprietors and whatever.
Yeah, partners. And so the... But a corporation is a creature of law. It requires some state law that you're incorporating under that law. And so what the law in Delaware says is you have sort of your regular C Corp, your regular corporations, and you have public benefit corporations. And the public benefit corporations, in addition to pursuing shareholder wealth, may also pursue the public benefit defined in their charter. And then the directors are now instructed to balance the interests.
Whatever that means.
So in that case, okay, you're saying that's what you bought into. That's what you invested into. So if your returns are less, don't come complain to anybody because that's the deal you wanted. Mm-hmm. And you might feel better about it. And in fact, the company might prosper.
Yeah. I guess what I was getting at is, do you think that fast forward 10 years, 5 years, whatever, that there's an exchange of just these public benefit corps or an exchange where whatever you're investing in are these types of companies that are materially sort of at a charter level, have a different type of mandate than everything else that's on the New York Stock Exchange or everything else that's on the NASDAQ? Or do you think they'll continue to exist? And I mean, we're just navel gazing at this point, but do you think they'll continue to exist on the same sort of exchange and people will just, you know, make those decisions over time with their voting with their dollars, you know?
I don't think Delaware is going to repeal the public benefit statutes in its corporate law. People might lose interest in them. I just don't know.
Yeah.
It could be this is going to become a permanent feature of investing. There are people who want to make all companies effectively public benefit corporations by amending the company law. Mm-hmm. Now, bear in mind that the part of Delaware's business model as a state is to make itself an extremely friendly place for major right. corporations to incorporate. And so if they could lose their luster as the premier place for incorporation, if they start pushing too far and say, well, all companies are public benefit companies in Delaware, people might say, well, that's not really where I want to invest because I want something that's going to maximize shareholder value. And so that this is the invisible hand at work, right?
Yeah, right.
Capital will go where it's welcome. Mm-hmm. You can see where, you know, there are the really wealthy hedge fund people are not moving to New York or New Jersey. They're moving to Florida.
Yeah.
Or they're moving.
What does that tell you? Nevada. To your point. Over time, this stuff is going to trickle where it's going to go, you know?
Capital will go where it is welcome. And the wealthiest people are the most mobile. And they're also the ones who can afford the best planning advice. So yeah, that's the cat and mouse game. I think with ESG, again, if it's intrinsically better, the people who are arguing it's intrinsically better, you should just say, well, then we don't need to mandate all this stuff because it's intrinsically better. Nobody mandates continuous improvement.
Correct.
Nobody mandates customer relationship management, because if you want to win in the marketplace, you better get good at it. And over time, the better models will work. The cream should rise.
Yeah, right.
And so if it's really a reputational issue, or it's either gives me better overall returns because people are factoring in the goodwill.
Yes.
Or that it's a reputation management issue, in both, which is under the dualism profit maximization camp. In both those cases, you need some common terms. You need some common methodologies.
Right.
So we know what we're talking about.
Right.
And then you then say, well, what happens if you misstate something intentionally or unintentionally? What should be the consequence of that misstatement? Is it simply a reputational hit, or are you now open to a lawsuit, and on what basis?
Yeah, great point. I mean, as I'm kind of, thinking about this in the future, like, you have two companies, one has a material misstatement on their financial statements, and then another one has a quote unquote material misstatement on their diversity disclosure in their 10K or something. So,
right.
How do you compare those? Which is worse? Which one is less virtuous, or which one is more bad? You know what I'm saying? Like, binarily, how do you, or like objectively, how do you compare those two things? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and part of the issue is to what extent has it been part of your brand, right?
Yeah,
what are the brand expectations? I mean, what happened? Missouri had a governor who celebrated his discipline and his propriety and his family values. And then he was caught with his zipper down. Mm-hmm. And that appears to be the end of his political career. He ended up resigning in disgrace. He was probably close to getting impeached, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And part of the issue there was his brand had been tied up in propriety and discipline and family values, and he just couldn't operate in that fashion. Whereas we did recently have a president who had a reputation of philandering, or presidents, depending on how far back you want to go.
Yeah.
And people just kind of said, well, okay, that's part of who he is. That's the rough with the smooth. And the allegations never seemed to stick because they weren't really inconsistent with the person's, I'll use
Great
the term
point.
Brand. I don't endorse the behavior, obviously, well, clearly, and I don't make light of it. But you raise the point, which is, what's the reputational damage? Well, part of the reputational damage has to do with what's your reputation to begin with, right? So if you're there are scandalous cases of people selling non-kosher meat labeled as kosher, all right? That's pretty bad. You can think of certain celebrities who have brands for certain kinds of behavior, and if they violate that, they're probably going to be has-beens pretty quickly. In the business field, you would also have to evaluate what the hit would be. So Boeing is now dealing still with the aftermath of its safety problems with the 737 MAX. I wrote a couple of Forbes columns on this. And that part of the problem was they seemed to have violated a pretty fundamental principle of aircraft design.
Totally.
Two of them, in fact. Or one is operation, one's design. As was said to me by a former F-15 pilot, when you pull back on the stick, the houses get smaller. Right. But they had put software into the MAX where that wasn't necessarily going to happen. And the second principle, which is one of operation, is you tell the pilot the condition of his craft. And if you sell the right stuff, but you got to tell the pilots how the things work. And the pilots were not fully informed about how the software systems operate. Mm. And sure enough, you had a situation where the pilot thought all they had to do was pull back on the stick and it didn't work. And the plane went in, two planes crashed into the ground.
Right.
So who trusts Boeing right now? Right? That's a real problem.
Right.
So, you know, and that's I'll call that a governance concern, right? Okay. Which is how are we operating? There are other things that are folded into governance, which I think would include diversity, equity, and inclusion. Because I don't think those belong in environmental. And most of the arguments for them do not really go under social. They tend to go under. Well, they tend to go under, we're not helping society, we're helping ourselves operate better. The people who are fostering diversity, equity, inclusion, I think are making the argument by and large, and they might be making, some people might make it in other fashions to say, companies that are diverse, equitable, and inclusive function better. It's a better mode of governance. So I tend to think of it there, but I would be open to people who think it should belong somewhere else. And this again is an area to say, well, in what context and to what extent? So there's an example, wrote an article on this involving about diversity, where the head of Wells Fargo Bank at one point was criticized for lack of African Americans at senior levels. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know, there just aren't enough out there to hire.
Right.
And he was roundly and appropriately criticized for the statement. I took a slightly different criticism, which is I said, you know what? If the guy's sales were down, would he say there aren't enough customers out there?
Yeah, right.
Right. The fact is we expect companies to compete for scarce resources, and good people are among the scarce resources. Mm-hmm. But there was also an example I gave of an African-American Deputy Chief of Naval Operations, who, when she was in charge of the African region for the Navy, had to deal with this pirate hijacking that became a Tom Hanks movie. Mm-hmm. And she's got a wonderful talk up on YouTube where she talks about how she put together a diverse team that would try very rapidly to figure out how do we deal with this vessel, which is sailing. It's an enclosed safety pod, which is heading towards Somali waters. And if it gets to Somali waters, we'll never rescue this captain.
Right.
So we have to stop the ship from going outside of international waters, but we can't use violence because that would either sink the ship or cause these guys to kill the hostage.
Right.
So she said she put together a diverse team. She said she got a pilot, she got an able-bodied seaman, she got a SEAL sniper, right? And what you realize from her description was that diversity is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself.
And correct. The
ends are better performance. And that happens in a couple of ways. One is I have to make sure that I'm not engaging in false negatives and false positives about somebody's abilities.
Correct.
And we have a tendency as human beings to assume that since we must, of course, be good at what we do, that people who remind us of us are probably good, and that people who don't remind us of us are not as good. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a false. The other one is the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. This goes to synergy. And so what she was describing in her diverse team was diversity with respect to the skills that applied to the matter at hand.
Right.
And so actually it was an able-bodied seaman who said, you know what, let's hit this thing with fire hoses. Because in the fire drills, this able-bodied seaman knew how powerful the fire hoses are on these ships. And that what they did was they could push the ship, the vessel that had been taken over by the pirates, they could actually push it back and it, you know, backwards by hitting it with a fire hose, mm-hmm. which is probably nothing a Navy SEAL, a SEAL sniper would ever have come up with, or an F-18 fighter jock wouldn't know. So, you know, to my mind, synergy depends upon what your goal is. So another example in basketball, generally speaking, in basketball, being tall is an advantage. But I think we might readily accept that a team filled with 7-footers would probably lose to a team that had a ball handler, mm-hmm. you know, a 3-point shooter, a fast break guy. And so you're thinking about the synergy, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So that is an aspect of diversity I'd like to see more fully explained, which is what are the factors that matter in relation to the goal that we have?
Yeah, right.
I think that's important. Equity actually is interesting because it comes from, there are several hundred years, 1,000 years of development of equity in Anglo-American law, which is tied to fairness, but also started to develop some internal constraints so that it wouldn't overwhelm other legal institutions like the parliament or the regular courts. And so I can say equity, but there have to be some logical constraints on how it operates, or else it just kind of spills over everything.
Yeah, just right.
And I have lack of equity. So these are the things I'm trying to explore in my work and in my corporate training and leadership development to say, okay, at the end of the day, we need to get some results.
Right.
And the results can be purely financial or they can be non-financial, but we have to understand where things come from and where they situate and what the counterbalances are so that we can function in a complex world and do so in a way that we can explain, which is also important to say, look, I'm not cold-hearted. I'm trying to create a great workplace where I retain, train, and motivate outstanding people, where I serve my customers well, where I contribute to my community, while I am also maximizing wealth for my shareholders, giving them an above average market return. So that's how I try to situate these things. And I think it's an important discussion that I'd like to see more people talking about. So it's not a monologue, right? I think you get it, right? Because you live in the real world and you have to balance stuff. And that's what I'd like to see more is a more nuanced discussion and a respectful discussion to say, hey, at the end of the day, we might not agree on this, but at least let's understand where we're coming from, where each other is coming from.
Yeah. And I think if someone's just looking at it differently, they're not necessarily like a nefarious person. Do you know what I'm saying?
No,
or they're not necessarily a cold-hearted person if they take the more sort of dualistic approach versus the, the other one.
The stuff is hard, approach, and it's hard. It's complicated. It's situated in different contexts that have to be thought about and perhaps treated differently.
Yeah.
So I think a healthy amount of respect for other people's motives and opinions and a certain amount of, careful discounting of our own biases, I think would be helpful. And that's kind of where I'm trying to move the discussion.
Well, this was phenomenal as usual. Really interesting conversation. I feel like we learned a lot, and it felt like we really kind of explored some of these sort of corners of this kind of monolith that this thing that's almost kind of becoming a monolith in the way that people talk about it. It's way more complex than we have sort of rating agencies, for lack of a better term. It's way more complex to kind of prove out, but it's part of the conversation, and it's being worked into businesses and organizations on some level. So it's going to be interesting to see how the next kind of 3 to 5 years kind of play out as this concept sort of actually settles operationally into, these businesses that are occupying our economy.
I hope that the market can work. In other words, that you have a variety of different approaches, which allows people to experiment and we get to see what actually seems to function best. Right. That's where I think you say a monolithic approach is dangerous.
Totally.
Dangerous because this stuff is hard and life is not monolithic. And so I'm arguing for a respectful diversity and inclusiveness as we think about this particular area.
Yeah. Remind us again where people can find you. Remind us where we can get your book. Pick up the book, please. It's a great book.
Okay.
But remind us where people can get in touch with you and stuff.
Well, my website is therightwaytowin.com. If you go there, you can access the book. I also put my Forbes columns online there. The full texts are available as some of the indication of some of the distribution content I have out there right now. And you can also freely contact me through that or through LinkedIn.
Awesome.
So it's a discussion I love that I think is very important. Love talking to you, and I love talking to any interested listeners.
Well, likewise, great episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.
Take care.